Talk given Saturday, 14th October 1978. First, let us consider this point about being at ease within oneself. If the living of the religious life brings us to the condition where we are at ease within ourselves, that is not a ground for assuming that the people whom we meet are also at ease within themselves. The person who is not at ease within himself, coming in contact with a person who is, experiences a strangeness, a degree of uncertainty, even of fear. What sort of a person is this who is like that? They can't make out what is the matter. Now, such people are in the majority in the world. Take the simple example, if you are engaged in any, say any of the public services in the country in which you are working together, have to work together with several other people. Now you know all that goes on in the public services as such. The behavior of people, their mode of carrying out their duty. Are they perfectly honest? Are they giving the best of themselves to their work? Or are they interested more in getting as much money as they can and giving as little service as they can? And so forth, you see. And then there are all the petty little envies and jealousies and the little intrusions of personal vanity and egoism. I'm as good as he, I ought to have the same salary and so forth. All that sort of thing goes on. Now, if one of them is seriously concerned with living the religious life, he tries to remain outside of all that pettiness and wrongdoing. We know that so much wrongdoing goes on in every department of life. See? And when he is in that condition, he is the odd man out, isn't he? And being the odd man out, and the others see it, and before they actually see it in operation, they sense it, that this fellow is not one of us. He doesn't want to come out on strike when we go on strike to demand this, that and the other for ourselves. One has to bear in mind such things. So, the person who, by living the religious life, has realized a degree of harmony, psychophysical harmony within his own being, coming in contact with a vast majority who have not realized that state of harmony, is bound to come up against them. You will find this everywhere, again and again, and it raises great problems, because one earns one's livelihood in this particular work in which one is engaged. And although one may disapprove, one in fact not merely disapprove, but see that the underlying morality of people's actual behavior and thinking and feeling and so forth is unmoral, and one wants to be away from it. Immediately there is conflict. And of course, the strange thing is that the person who not only tries but to any degree succeeds in living the good life is the person who will get hurt by the situation and the behavior of those who do not live the good life, because they will regard this man as a menace to the fulfillment of their desires, their pursuits, their ambitions, and so on. This is always the case. People often question the justice of life, the justice of God, or whichever way they like to put it. Why should this man, who is really a good man, have to suffer for being good, whereas those others, carrying on with evil ways, lord it over him and the situation as a whole? But that is always the case. One has to pay the penalty for goodness, which takes one outside the deficiencies and the drawbacks of the herd. So that is one point in that connection. And this other point about loving one's neighbor as one's self. When one says loving one's self, what precisely is implied in that statement? We all know the ordinary meaning of self-love, how it is a divisive factor, how it is a root source of evil and trouble, misery, sorrow, illness in the world. But self-love in that sense is something which isolates one from reality, from truth, from goodness, and so forth. What is this thing I call myself? If I were capable of being quite impartial and looking at myself, I will find that I arrogate all sorts of virtues to myself, which may be there in some degree, but nowhere near the degree to which I think they are there, and I soft pedal all my vices, many of which I don't look at all, because I turn my blind spot to them, and those which I cannot avoid seeing, I soft pedal them, finding reasons how and why these little drawbacks in my nature are there. I'm not such a bad fellow after all, you know, and that sort of attitude, whereas I am a much better chap than so-and-so or so-and-so. You see, this is the sort of level of immaturity at which we live, and this is a fact. So now, what do we mean by loving oneself? And since that teaching comes in the Torah first, in the Old Testament, the books of Moses, and it is upheld by all Christendom, we have to inquire, what did the teachers, the great perfected holy ones, mean when they taught a thing like that? Love thy neighbor as thyself. What is the self in its true and complete sense? Now, we have something really remarkable to consider. We refer to ourselves by the word I, aham in Sanskrit and Pali, who in Gujarati, ego in Latin, and so forth. We refer to the self that way. You see? Now, what is the full and complete meaning of the word I? Does it stop short at my skin? And only what is inside this this skin bag is the I, including its psychical counterpart, if you like, you see? Is that the I? Consider very carefully. Look at its living process. It breathes first and foremost. It is absolutely indispensable for its existence. Where did that air come from? Came from the not I, from something outside me, I say. I breathe it in, it does its work, and I breathe out again, putting a little more carbon dioxide into the air when I breathe out. All right. Now, does the word I include the breath which I took in from outside and the breath which I breathed out outside? Because inside my lungs, it got included within the skin bag, didn't it? Now, take food, take drink. All this process goes on. So, we have to concede that the word I does not end with this skin. It's something more than that, this living thing. Then look at it from the point of view of relationships with the world, with people. Can I exist without the rest of humanity? I wouldn't have come into existence even. Can I exist if the animal world were cut out? If the plant world were cut out? If light and warmth and all the processes of nature were cut out? Can I exist for a split second even if all this was absent, that which I call the not I? I mean, even a small portion of the not I, the 200 or 300 cc's of air or whatever it is that I breathe in with any one breath, even if that little bit of air were unavailable, there'd be nothing inside this skin bag left. Isn't that so? So the word I must of necessity include that. Then I say that, oh, my mind, my psyche, and so forth. Well, all these mental processes, are they my property? Are they actually existent permanently inside this limited sphere? They are not. They are inherited, partly they come about through our process of upbringing and education and communication with people and so forth. So our mental life is not exclusively something which I can call mine. And if you go on like that, you will end up with the fact that the only true and complete meaning of the word I is the totality. The total cosmos is I. You know that lovely phrase which ends Edwin Arnold's poem, The Light of Asia, the dewdrop slips into the shining sea. Put it the other way around. The sea moves into the shining dewdrop. That is the total self. The only thing which can be called self in the profound and true way, and that is the meaning of the word I. The word ahang, as used in Pali and Sanskrit, stands for the unabandonable. And what is it that cannot be abandoned in the sense of completely given up, completely rooted out of existence? What is abandonable? Nothing at all. It cannot, there is nothing which can be annihilated. It can only be transformed. It is still part of the total cosmos. You are the total cosmos. The total cosmos is embodied in you. And this is the full and deep meaning of the word self. Now, take the other word, love, to love the self. What does love mean? Is attachment love? Is possessive desire for this, that or the other as an object or person love? These are all the rather shadowy, strange, dark forms manifest in our lives which we call love. It is right to call that love only insofar as we haven't awakened to the truer and truer and more complete meanings of the word love. Now, to love the totality, what does it imply? No jealousy, no envy, no hate, no impatience, and all the rest of it. It implies all that, doesn't it? Because if I'm in conflict with my neighbor, I'm not exactly loving him, am I? If I'm attached to my neighbor, if I'm dependent upon him, that also is a bondage upon him. And therefore, that is not love in its loveliness. Isn't that so? So now, what is the meaning of love the self? Be completely in union with the totality. That is loving the self. And then, when we use our limited senses of the finite, limited organism which goes by our name, when we see what we commonly and justifiably in this situation call the other person, my neighbor, your neighbor, then if we have that same relationship with him in our total consciousness of complete relationship, whatsoever it may be the relationship which is sometimes called friendship and sometimes called enmity, whatever it may be, but if there is this total acceptance, this total at-one-ment with it, then one is loving one's neighbor. A is my friend, B is my enemy. All right, that's the fact in outward appearance. But they are both my fellow human beings. I cannot deny nature's absolute fact. They are both my fellow human beings. And if there is this profound understanding which stands under and sustains all the manifestations of the relationship between any one person and myself, then whether he be a friend or an enemy, whether he acts as a friend or acts as an enemy, this understanding is the great healing power, the great power which makes for the cohesion of complete and total and irrefragable, unbreakable relationship at the profoundest level of one's consciousness. Then that's loving oneself and loving one's neighbor. And who is capable of doing that? Who is capable of being the natural and spontaneous representative of that kind of functioning? Every one of us has that as a potentiality. 4,000 millions of us have that as a potentiality. But that which is a divine potentiality comes to fruition in terms of perfect manifestation only in the few. You have a great tree, but the whole of that tree is not fruit only or flower only. It has roots, it has a main trunk and a bark and this, that and the other, so many millions of leaves and so many less millions, if it is that much at all, a few hundred fruits or something, or flowers, which appear on it. That is the way of life. Now if we understand that, we will realize that each one of us, although potentially capable of being the full flower of humanity, need not necessarily be the means through which that flowering of humanity fully manifests itself. Need not necessarily be. But we have our own part to play. And if we are free of envy, free of ambition, free of selfness, the selfness which says, I want to attain, I want to become a Christ, a Buddha, a Beethoven, or whatever it is. If that nonsense is out, then in a wonderful way, the totality gets expressed in perfection and marvelous beauty through the limited particular. Through a leaf, through one cell in that great tree, and so forth. You see, the liberation of the heart. Heart not meaning feelings merely, or emotions merely, or hunches or anything like that. The liberation of the heart means the liberation of fundamental truth. This essence, this word essence which we use, the essence of anything and everything, that is the heart of the matter, as we say. And that essentiality does find expression in its innumerable ways through us. We need not all of us be representative flowers of humanity in the sense that the perfected holy ones through the ages have been. So you see, if one really sees this, all our absurd ambitions of a passion to achieve for ourselves, that's what it comes to. I want to be the perfect yogi. You never will be the perfect yogi. I want to be the perfect saint. You will never be the perfect saint. Because when one talks in those terms, I want to be this, that and the other, if you are capable of a little intelligent self-perception, you will discover they are referring to your limited self, the finite mortal thing, the perishable thing. not to the imperishable. And yet it is imperishability, the imperishability of the total truth, which is embodied in the perishable. And that is the beauty and the wonder, the marvel of cosmic manifestation. And every single little bit of cosmic manifestation. It is man's destiny, man's glory, if you like to use that term, to wake up to this kind of thing and let it express itself. Don't try to express it. Because in the trying to express it, one is immediately in conflict with that which we see prevents the expression. As long as we are in conflict with that which prevents the expression never comes about. All that is wonderful, beautiful, perfect emerges. It is not made. It is not something put together. Sankata, a sankhara, a confection, a precise patterning which we want to keep as a fixation, a fixed ideal as we call it, a fixed goal. These are all the illusions and delusions from which we suffer. See what lies ahead. Try and see it truthfully. That is unavoidable, and that is proper procedure, unquestionably. But what you see a little bit ahead is not the finality. If it were, and you were to attain it, you have stopped growing. And if you continue to live after that, God help you, you have just become a fossil. A live cabbage. I mean a human cabbage. Well, you might be very edible still, but but you see the absurdity of it. Now, these are the things we suffer from. If we can really see this and are prepared to let life proceed unhindered by us in any way, then perfect yoginess, perfect sainthood keeps manifesting through you in ever more and more beautiful and wonderful and great forms. Otherwise you are stuck in the mud, stuck in the mud of your own beauty and your perfection. You see, it just goes on and on. And manifested existence in itself realizes its fulfillment and its the purpose of its existence insofar as it is able to produce a perfect balance of opposing tensions. Bear that in mind. This is a lesson which we can learn from our very body itself. The healthy body is one in which the whole system is a wonderful balance of opposing tensions. You look at a youngster who is a fine athlete and healthy and this, that and the other. All his muscular working is a perfect manifestation of the balance of opposing tensions. A dynamic balance, not a static balance which keeps him stuck in one place. Not that. Not this very simple Newtonian action and reaction are equal and opposite. But this dynamic poise which enables one state of opposing tensions being balanced to grow into the next state, which is a more advanced state always, and this is the meaning of progress and so forth. Now you see why we have to just see ahead in the moment what we can see ahead and no more. Do not cling to that, because as soon as you have arrived there, and you will undoubtedly arrive there if you let yourself arrive there, then you just stop dead, unless you are prepared to accept the fact that what you see ahead is always ahead. Isn't that so? I mean, this applies with a simple traveling. If you're driving your car from here to, where shall we say, Leatherhead or whatever it is, well, you first come to this town, then to that village, then to that village, and your brain just naturally accepts the fact that, yes, we are here, and on we go still, and on we go still, until you arrive at Leatherhead for tea, 5 minutes to time. It's the same with regard to our psychological and our spiritual growth. And our psychological and spiritual growth is not like this analogy of moving in space, where things are concrete and fixed as they are. Leatherhead remains where Leatherhead is. It doesn't move. You see, that's the goal for the time being. But where our own psyche and our own dormant mental faculties are concerned, there is no stopping. It's an ever-unfolding process. You know how easily we say, oh, I want to reach enlightenment. I want to follow in the footsteps of the Lord Jesus Christ, etc., etc., etc. But I've got a fixed idea of it. Is my idea the idea of an imperfect creature like me at all? Does it at all fit in with the reality of a Christ consciousness or a Buddha consciousness or enlightenment or any such thing? Not at all. It doesn't. Is this I want to be, I want to do, the bhava-sava that the Buddha talked of, and the kama-sava, the passion to achieve, the desire and so forth. All that is the hindrance to it. So one has to learn to become free of all these things. And then we will find that the problems which confront us, for the very reason that we are living the religious life in truer and truer measure, those problems will vanish. Why? Because the problem is actually oneself. What is a problem? Something which one doesn't understand. And what is it that doesn't understand? Not something outside this person who is trying to understand. It's inside the person. It's not outside. So oneself, one's state of confusion is the problem. State of confusion, state of driven by ambition, driven by the pleasure drive, subject to all sorts of delusions and illusions, our fixed beliefs, the dogmas of the religions are not necessarily untrue. The dogmas are there. They represent something. It is my clinging to my fixed idea of what that meaning is, which is the trouble. You take teachings like the virgin birth and immaculate conception and all that. They are absolutely true on their plane, at their level. It is my interpretation of the thing which is so hopelessly false. Take fundamentalists, for instance. Every word of the Bible is true, literally true. God did make the world in 6 days. 144 hours. What a clever chap. In 144 hours he made the whole world. They believe that literally. Now, you see, these statements have their own meanings. One has to have the key to unlock, to release the true meaning. And when one does that, then the mind is free. The dogma isn't false. The doctrine isn't false. Because every statement is a symbolical statement. The word is not the thing. The photograph is not the living person. It is a photograph of the living person. But it presents a fixed image in one particular posture, at one particular time, moment, when he was in this, that, or the other mood, or whatever it is, and that is all which is represented in that photograph. Isn't that the case? So it is with all our statements, with all our ideas, and so forth. Understanding all this, we become more flexible. Then we find that the problems which crop up in attempting to live the religious life, being at ease with others, and others being at ease with us, that problem, if its roots in us disappear, that is to say, get transformed into true perception, then we exert a continuous healing influence upon those around, upon the whole environment. And that environment, especially in terms of the human beings around us and their interrelationship with us, that undergoes change. It may take a lifetime, and even then that may be quite insufficient. But it changes in some way or other. And oneself, because one is cleansed of obstructions to truth within oneself, oneself is a perpetual healing influence, a benediction upon one's environment. This is the meaning of being a religious man, living a religious life. This is one meaning of it. Then loving your neighbor as yourself becomes filled with marvelous reality. In connection with the question of sensitivity, every living creature has sensitivity as one of the marks, characteristics of a living creature. That's how we know this is a live creature. If that creature, when that creature dies, it has no more sensitivity at all. It cannot either react or truly respond to any stimulus that is presented to it. And in the case of the dead, of the corpse, there is no stimulus that arises from within that corpse. In our human lives, there are the stimuli that arise from within us in terms of the natural functioning of the body, hunger and this, that and the other, There are the stimuli which arise psychologically because of memories, anticipations, and because of the actual movement of our thought and feeling process from within. And of course, we all know the multitudinous stimuli from the outside world to which we are susceptible. Now, these stimuli come upon us and arise from within us, and we react to them. Now, most of us, for the greater part of our lives, react helplessly. We can't control the reaction. It is just there at once. Meaning thereby that we cannot remain perfectly poised and take in all that the stimulus conveys to us or raises up from within us. We can't take it in. See? Now, this is directly related to the fact that we are self-conscious in the limiting sense. We are self-conscious as individuals separate from what we miscall the not-I, the not-self. And we are the slaves, the absolute abject slaves of our passion for the pleasant, for what, that is to say, what we like. This is what we want, and so forth. And we have aversion towards that which is unpleasant. We can't take it. A person says something and we are hurt. And we feel an antagonistic reaction. That is that particular type of sensitivity, the helpless reaction in terms of antagonism. Then if somebody is nice to us, says very flattering things, oh, what a wonderful man you are, what a beautiful woman you are, and all the rest of it, then that satisfies our vanity and our egoism, and we get attached to that person. This is how we react in that case. And it's a helpless reaction. We just do not remain poised within ourselves. But through true self-observation, through the practice of true mindfulness, learning to be aware of exactly what is happening, both in terms of that which comes to us and in terms of what goes out of us through the activity of our brain, either approving, disapproving, praising, censuring, accepting, rejecting what the stimulus brings to us. If we are fully awake to that, we begin to see things in their wholeness. That is to say, not things or situations or people as merely outside us, but as completely including us. Now, a new kind of sensitivity emerges. Our capacity for sensitivity is the natural characteristic of the living person. That you can't avoid. It is there. Our natural capacity is there. But by this kind of mindfulness, this watch, as Jesus said, you see, this watchfulness, or the attentiveness, as Krishnamurti says, you see, through that we develop the power of remaining poised. Because when you become aware of the whole situation, which includes yourself, all the false judgments which we are accustomed to make, either in terms of appreciation and approval, or in terms of condemnation and so forth, all the likes and dislikes from which we suffer, they all begin to disappear. You will notice that your awareness becomes a truly impartial, like a judge in the court, a really great judge. Some of you may have sometimes visited a courtroom and seen how a judge functions. I remember particularly in pre-war days, I have heard Lord Chief Justice Goddard sit there, sum up the case. I watched him, no expression on his face to divulge what he himself was thinking at the moment, hearing the evidence. You see? Perfect poise, perfect calm. And then in the summing up, a truly poised summing up, he would talk like this. Now, so, this witness, so and so, has given this evidence, which I do not believe. You see, quietly just saying he was lying all along the line. I mean, everybody said, but there was no reaction against that man. And he would point out anything which was worthwhile in his evidence, in mitigation of this, that, or the other, or whatever it may be. And so on. That poise and that power of seeing the fact as the whole fact grows in us. And when that grows in us, this dormant sensitivity to be able to take in anything and everything into the psyche, refusing admittance to nothing whatsoever, grows. When that grows, you are truly man. Now, this is humanness in fine measure being manifest through the individual. And it is that kind of sensitivity which is absolutely essential if there is a real spiritual progress by which the particular individual comes to fruition. Is that...
Yes, it's very... One can start to see it more, I think, in terms of oneself with the sort of pleasures and things. But when it involves other people suffering or cruelty around one, then one finds one that one is reacting emotionally. And obviously it is from the self-centre, because I don't like to see this happening. But still, that it seems more difficult to keep calm about it if it's not oneself that is specifically involved.
Let me put it this way. Supposing one can put oneself into the shoes of the absolute, of the primordial creative energy, into the shoes of God, the Godhead, the sole complete creator of the entire universal process, permeating it, omnipresent, omnipotent, omniscient, and all the rest of it. Now, does God accept this and not accept that? Could that be? Because if that could be, he is not accepting a part of himself. He is in conflict within himself. But we don't ascribe that conflict to him. We say the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, don't we? Now, supposing we come down to our bodily level, supposing we have some little ailment or something there. If we are truly intelligent, we do not fight against it. We look at it, we understand it, And we do what is needful in order that it may be healed. And that is all there is to it. There is no partiality with respect to our own body. We take our whole body for granted as it is. All its pleasant and good aspects, as we call them, as well as its unpleasant and evil aspects, troublesome aspects. We take it for granted, don't we? Now, the cruelty, the horror, horrible things that happen in the world, if we cannot remain poised and see the thing as a whole process in which all this happens, undoubtedly, you see, we can't be a healing influence at all as individuals. If the surgeon were to hate the patient on whom he is operating, he might probably send off that person to the higher planes forever and ever. You see, it's like that. This capacity for complete acceptance in terms of wholeness. Otherwise, we are just talking about wholeness. It is there. It's terrible. It is awful. But you cannot destroy it. It can be transformed. And it may not rest with you in your destiny to transform it. May not. But you may be constrained by circumstance to look on helplessly. These are some of the great trials which come across us, which come across our path. See, people always want to rush in and put the matter right. If they look carefully into themselves and inquire, why do I want to step into this? You'll always find that there is incapacity within oneself to see the fact, the whole fact, in its true light. It may rest with somebody else to be the instrument for changing that particular bad situation. In the meantime, our patience, our forbearance, which means the true spirit of forgiveness, forgiveness. Let go, don't hurt. Resist not evil. That comes into play. These are all very difficult things to put into practice, I know. They are terribly difficult things.